The Fuller Memorandum, Disc 2.
Chapter 3. Things That Go Bump in the Daylight. I emerge from the staff entrance to the CNA on the high street, blinking like a groundhog caught in the headlights of an onrushing Hummer. It is a Wednesday, just before the lunchtime rush, and the pavements are full of shoppers and people with nowhere better to go. A herd of buses rumble past, farting clouds of sulphurous biodiesel and lunging at cyclists. But I am not at work. Something is wrong with the world. Something is broken. A wire has come loose in my soul. I start to walk. I don't want to go home just yet. It's 60 to 70 minutes of riding on two buses, but then I'll have nothing to do but sit staring at the walls for the rest of the afternoon. If it was a normal summer's day, I could go for a walk on Wandsworth Common. It's only about a mile or two from here, but the sky is overcast and grey, threatening rain later on. Or I could go into town, maybe get the tube to Euston and visit the British Library. I've got a reader's card, and there are some interesting manuscripts I've been meaning to look at for a while, relevant to the job. No, I can hear Iris ticking me off in the back of my head, telling me that's not what I ought to be doing when I'm on medical leave. In the end, I walk to the next bus stop just in time to see the tail end of the herd vanishing round the corner, and wait nearly 10 minutes for the next bunch of buses to arrive, with only my iPod for company. That and a couple of students, a pensioner pushing a shopping bag on wheels, and an Uncle Fester type in a dirty trench coat who is pointedly not making eye contact with anyone. I sit on the top deck for 40 minutes as it slowly migrates towards Victoria, then hop off and head for an all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet for lunch. It's stowed out, as you can imagine, because I've hit peak lunchtime, but it makes a welcome change from the dismal little pie shop round the corner from the new annex. I emerge into daylight with a full stomach and my sense of well-being marginally restored. It's trying to rain, lonely drips spattering the pavement and evaporating before they can join up. I shuffle along with the tourists and foreign language students and shirking office workers, staring into shop windows and feeling faintly wistful. Something nagging at the back of my mind. The penny drops. My PDA. Okay, it's laundry issue, but it's toast. Sure, I have a cheap, dumb mobile phone as well, but I relied on that PDA. It had my life embedded in its contacts and calendar. Yes, there's a backup, but it's on my office PC, which is most definitely not a laptop, and most definitely not allowed to go home with me. The last thing the laundry needs is headlines like, Civil Servant Loses Laptop. Entire population of Tower Hamlets eaten by gibbering horrors from beyond space-time. So, for the time being, I'm adrift. If Mo called me right now, I genuinely couldn't phone Pete and Sandy. Help, it's a crisis. Well, okay, it's a minor crisis, but I rationalize. Obsessing over my lost address book is a lot healthier than obsessing over a blinding purple flash and an imploding face. Besides, shopping is therapeutic, right? I pull out my phone and look at it in distaste. It's a cheap Motorola jobby with a pay-as-you-go SIM, and its major virtues are that it's small and it makes phone calls. I bought it a year and a half ago when word went round that IT services were threatening to inflict arseberries on us, along with a centralized work directory, and start billing for personal calls. The rumor turned out to be unfounded, but I kept the phone. And the PDA I wangled Andy into signing off on, because between them, they did a better job than the old trio. And besides, all smartphones are shit these days. It's the one industry where progress is going backwards in high gear, because the yakking masses would rather use their phones as car navigation systems and cameras than actually make phone calls or read email. About the only smartphone that doesn't stink like goose shit is the Jesus phone, but I've steadfastly refused to join the cult of Jobs, ever since I first saw the Happy Clappy Revival tent launch. It brought back painful memories of a junior management training course the late and unlamented Bridget sent me on a few years ago. Nothing can possibly be that good, even though the specifications look rather nice on paper, right? You know how this is going to end. I spend an hour shuffling around mobile phone shops, comparing specifications and feeling my brains gently melting, which confirms what I already knew. All mobile phones are shit this year. Then I allow my feet to carry me into the O2 shop and plant me in front of an austerely minimalist display stand where halogen lights play their spotlight beams across the polished fascia of a Jesus phone. a halo of purity gleaming above it. "Can I help you, sir?" beams one of the sales staff. "That thing." My finger points at the Jesus phone, as if drawn to it by a powerful gesh. "How much?" That's the only question that matters, you see. I've already memorized its specifications. "The 64-gigabyte model, sir, on an 18-month contract." The Jesus phone, I swear, it is smiling at me. "Come to me. Come to me and be saved." The luscious curves, the polished glissade of the icons in the multi-touch interface. Whoever designed that thing is an intuitive illusionist, I realize fuzzily as my fingertip closes in on the screen. That's at least a Class 5 glamour. The next thing I think is, I shouldn't have let myself get so close. But by then, I'm on my way out of the store, clutching a carrier bag and a receipt that says I've put a dent in my bank balance big enough that Mo's going to have something new to swear about this month, to the benefit of Apple's shareholders. I slink home with my metaphorical tail between my legs, clutching my shiny new Jesus phone like a consolation prize for my lack of a real life. It is 4 p.m. The cool rains have brought their gurgling freight of water to the overflowing gutter above the kitchen window, and I'm sitting at the table with a laptop and a freshly jailbroken Jesus phone when the doorbell chimes. You didn't expect me not to jailbreak an iPhone so I can run unsigned applications on it, did you? That would be no fun at all. I get up and slouch towards the front porch.
Surprise party!
It's a pair of familiar faces. Pinky is holding the umbrella while Brains hefts a pair of beer casks at me. I take a step back. Hey, what's the big deal?
Beware of geeks bearing beer.
Pinky cocks his head and looks at me madly as Brains makes a beeline for the kitchen and clears some counter space.
We heard about the whoopsie and figured you might want some company.
Pinky and Brains, the ex-flatmates from heck, if not hell. I used to share a house with them, back in the days when I was still seeing Mary. They're a matched couple of geeks, working for technical support these days. Gizmo's department, Dirty Tricks Directorate. Brains does the hardware. Pinky does human factors and delivery flourishes. And both of them do the Pride March around Regent's Park every summer, even though they don't need to be publicly out to maintain their security clearances these days. A voice calls from the kitchen.
Hey, who let that thing in here?
I go back inside hastily. It's mine, as of this afternoon.
Mine, precious.
Brains is bending over my new phone.
Jailbroken it yet? I've been doing some evaluation work on these too. They look promising.
Don't be silly. I peer at the beer casks. He's lined them up next to the sink.
Hey, that's not nitro pressurized. That's right, they're cask conditioned,
Brain says proudly.
Normally, you have to leave them 24 hours to drop bright after you tap them, but with this...
He produces a home brew box of electronics from one waterproof pocket.
You can cut the wait to 60 minutes.
What is it? I pause. If it's a temporal multiplexer, I've got to warn you, last time we had one in here, Mo had to beat the fridge contents to death with a cricket bat. She was most annoyed.
Nope, it's ultrasonic.
He switches it on as he plants it on top of the first cask, and I feel my jaw muscles clench. Ultrasonic it may be, but it's got some low-frequency harmonics that remind me unpleasantly of a mosquito the size of a Boeing 737. Switch it off, please. Pinky is doing something bizarre to the umbrella, turning it inside out through its own center. I do a double take. Is that really a Mobius strip umbrella? And it vanishes, except for a stubby handle which he hangs on the inside doorknob. I blink. To what do I owe the honour?
Iris says you could do with some company,
Brain says blandly as my phone chirps and does an incoming text shimmy on the counter. I grab it. It's a message from Mo. Unavoidably detained by work, don't stay up. I might not be wearing a ward around my neck right now. I didn't stay in the office long enough to sign out a replacement for the one I toasted yesterday. But it's not my only defence, and right now my this-is-a-setup gland is pulsing painfully. This is a put-up job, right? What's going on? I glance at the front hall, half expecting the doorbell to ring again and Boris and Andy to be standing there, along with a briefing on some kind of harebrained operation.
Don't be silly, Bob,
Brain says crisply.
Iris just got word that your fragrant wife has been called away to an incident in Amsterdam, and she thought someone ought to keep you company today. The saintly Mo should be back tomorrow. Until then, we drew the short straw.
He gestures at the beer.
Just like old times, huh?
No, it's not just like old times, I snort. Then the penny drops.
Job in Amsterdam?
They needed a lead violin.
Oh, I say, feeling very small. There is this about being married to Mo. Every few months she gets called to an unexpected job somewhere in Europe, at short notice, with her violin. A philosopher by academic training and a combat epistemologist by subsequent specialization, she doesn't talk about what happens on those trips, but I get to hold her shoulders and calm her when she wakes in the pre-dawn gloom, shuddering and clammy. Years ago, shortly after we first met, we got into a situation where I ended up rescuing her from... Well, it wasn't nice, and she overcompensated, I think. The violin's an Eric Zahn original, refitted with Hilbert Space pickups. There's a black-on-yellow sticker on its case that says, "This machine kills demons." And sometimes she sits up late into the night, playing music on it that I don't want to think about. I pick up my phone and thumb-tap back at her. "Enjoy Amsterdam and take care. XXX." Then I put it down carefully, as if it might explode. Now I've got something to worry about, something to distract me from feeling sorry for myself because of the inquiry, or gnawing over the hollow sense of gnawing wrongness as I see Helen's face melting away in front of my eyes again and again. Something tangibly threatening to be upset about. If anything happens to Mo, I don't know what I'll do. It's not as if my parents or elder brother know what I do for a living. They think I'm just a junior civil servant. The same goes for Mo, only more so. Her dad's dead, mum's a ditz, and her kid's sister's married to an engineer in Dubai. We're isolated, but we can confide in each other, do the mutual support thing that so many couples don't seem to do. We understand each other's problems, which means that right now I'm drinking for two. In the fridge, top shelf on the left, there's an open bottle of wine, I say, standing and making for the cupboard to root out some glasses. You guys didn't drive, did you?
That would be irresponsible, Bob, Pinky says soberly. Is this the right bottle?
Give it here. I pause for a moment, bottle poised over an inviting glass. Boris doesn't have anything to do with this, does he? You're quite sure it was Iris's idea?
Don't be silly, Bob, says Brains, taking the bottle and the glass. Boris is on detached duty with a dustbin this year. Here, take this. How about a toast? Confusion to the enemy.
I raise my glass. What enemy? He shrugs.
IT, human resources, the grim march of time. Whoever you want, really.
I'll drink to that, says Pinky, and I nod.
It's going to be a long evening, but it was going to be a long evening anyway, and at least this way I don't get to spend it brooding on my own. The next morning, I awaken to find that my mouth tastes as if a rat used it for a bed and breakfast, and Mo still isn't here. I roll over, reaching across her side of the bed. Empty. It's early, but I yawn and sit up, then visit the bathroom to change the rat's bed linen before stumbling downstairs. The kitchen sink is full of empty bottles, and someone left a Jesus phone on the kitchen table plugged into my laptop. Oh, shit. It wasn't a dream then. I switch the kettle on and run a comb through my hair, wondering if I can take the bloody thing back. I haven't activated it, have I? Oh. There's a handwritten note next to it. I read it with a sinking heart. Hi, Bob. Hope you like the Easter eggs, Brains. No, I can't take it back. Not until I find out what Brains did to it. I rack my memories for any hint of details, but it's all a bit of a blur. I remember him saying something about evaluation work. Jesus, he could have put anything on it. Not that Brains would install classified experimental work-related software on an agent's personal mobile phone. Oh, no. But if he thought it had been issued to me by work, that would be another matter entirely. I turn the radio on just as the kettle rises to a rattling, rolling boil and shuts off. I pull the cafetiere out of the cupboard and spoon coffee into it. Pour water and stare at it, as if that'll make it brew faster.
It is just occurring to me that today is a Thursday and I'm not expected to... Nope, scratch that. I'm expected not to go into the office today. And I haven't the foggiest idea what to do with myself. It's not like a holiday, meticulously planned fun and frolics on a beach with Mo, or even a weekend of vegging out in front of the TV at home. It feels more like I'm under house arrest. Sick leave is no fun at all when you're doing it on instructions from management. The radio is blatting on about the news. Prime Minister talking about the need for faith schools. Something about a UN Population Fund meeting in the Netherlands. An idiot footballer getting an idiot multi-million pound handshake from an idiot football team. All the usual cheerily oblivious rubbish we listen to in order to feel connected. Right now, it sounds like it's bleeding in from another world. I carefully lower the plunger on the cafetiere. It's balky and has a tendency to squirt hot coffee grounds everywhere, if you don't do it just right. Then pour myself a mug and sit down in front of the Jesus phone. Gosh, that thing's shiny. Now, what can brains have done? It doesn't take me long to find out. The icon that looks like a tumble dryer is a bit of a giveaway, come to think of it. I groan and stab the thing with my thumb, and a whole bunch of new icons show up. What the fuck? I swear quietly. There's a lot more to this than just evaluation work. Those of us who do field work have a whole suite of specialized software tools we need to carry about. Most of them don't require any particular hardware. They just need a general-purpose processor that can do some rather unusual, number-intensive calculations. And the new phone's got plenty of grunt in that department. This looks like a first pass at porting the entire occult field countermeasures utility trunk to run native on Jesus phone, which means I can forget about returning it to the shop, for starters. Brains has unintentionally taken a huge stinking shit all over our security frontline, installing classified software on an unapproved and unauthorized device. It was just an obvious misunderstanding and no harm's come about, and as soon as I can smuggle the phone back into the new annex and get him to wipe the fucking thing back to factory condition, we can pretend it never happened. But until then, I'm going to have to carry the thing on my person at all times and defend it with my life. Well, that, or I can set operational oversight on him, but my life doesn't need the excitement of being the subject of two simultaneous boards of inquiry. Jesus, brains, I murmur. Is it something in the water? I poke at the option set up in Offcut admiringly. He's done a thorough job of porting it. This is almost as tightly integrated as the old version I used to have on my Trio, before they pulled it because it violated our ROHS waste disposal statement. Half an hour later, my old and unwanted Motorola rings. I pick it up and see withheld on the display, which means one of two things, a telemarketer or work, because I put my unclassified desk phone on call divert. Yes?
Bob?
It's Andy, my one-time manager. Nice guy, when he's not stabbing you in the back. What's up? You know I'm on...
Yes, Bob. It's about Mo.
I sit down hard.
She's flying into London City from Amsterdam on KL-1557.
My heart starts up again.
And I think it would be a really good idea if you were to meet her in. She's due to land around 9. You can just get there if you leave in the next 10 minutes.
What's happened to her? I realize I'm gripping the phone too hard and force myself to open my fist. It wouldn't do to break the bloody thing before I've ported my number across.
Nothing, he says too quickly. Look, will you just... I'm going. I'm dragging myself from my sickbed, groaning and limping in my nightgown to the airport, okay?
I look round, trying to locate my shoes. I dumped them in the hall the night before.
Are you sure she's okay?
Not entirely, he says quietly and hangs up. I'm dressed and out of the house like a greased whippet, round the corner to the tube station and the train to Bank, and then the DLR line to London City Airport, out in the East End near Canary Wharf. I remember to grab the Jesus phone at the last minute, shoveling it into an inside zippered pocket in my fishing vest. I'm at the DLR platform waiting for a train before I realize I've forgotten to shave. If Andy is yanking my chain... All doubts fade when I get to arrivals at 10 to 11 and see KL-1557 on the board, on schedule for 15 minutes hence. If she's hurt... But she won't be. At least not physically.
In her line of work, if something goes wrong, it's probably fatal. At best, she'd be clogging up a hospital high dependency unit, and I'd be on my way out to see her with many hand-wringing apologetics and a complimentary budget price ticket from human resources. Hanging around in an airport arrivals hall is not a good thing to do if you're nervous. I can feel the cop's eyes on the back of my neck, wondering what the unshaven, agitated guy who can't keep his feet still is doing. The minutes and seconds trickle by with glacial, infuriating slowness. Then the arrivals board changes the flight status to arrived. And there she is, coming out of the door from baggage claim in the middle of a clot of suits, violin case slung over her shoulder. Freckled skin stretched over high cheekbones, long red hair tied back out of her face, uncharacteristically dressed in office drag. That's unusual. Must be urban camouflage for whatever she's been sent to do. Something about her gait, or the set of her shoulders, tells me she's bone-deep weary. I wave. She sees me and changes course, and I move towards her and we collide in a deep embrace that ends in a kiss. She pulls back after a couple of seconds.
Get me home, please.
She sounds low.
Andy said, Andy is a wee ball bag and we're going home. Taxi, right now.
She's leaning on me, swaying slightly. Mo, what's wrong?
Later.
She draws a deep, shuddering breath.
Right now, let's go home.
Can you walk? She nods.
Okay, we'll get a taxi.
It'll be about 20 quid. I can't afford to make a habit of it, but scratch worrying about money for the time being. If she feels too crap to face the tube... We ride home in silence, wincing in synchrony as we bump over speed pillows and sway through chicanes and suffer all the other traffic-annoying measures that slow down ambulances and cost lives and triple the price of a simple taxi ride. I pay the driver and hold the door open for her, and then we're inside our front hall again, the door shut behind us, and she slumps against the wall as if she's just run a marathon. Coffee, tea, or something stronger? I ask.
Coffee.
She pauses. With something stronger. After a moment, she levers herself up and shuffles into the living room, then collapses on the overstuffed sofa we inherited from her sister Liz when she emigrated. I hurry back into the kitchen and refill the caff, then add a generous shot of cooking whiskey to her mug. When I get back to the living room, she's still on the sofa, her violin case sitting on the pile of magazines on the coffee table. She seems to be shaking at first in silent laughter. Then I realize she's crying. I put the coffee mugs on the table and sit down next to her. After a moment, she shuffles round and I pull her against my shoulder so that her tears trickle down the base of my neck. Mo cries helplessly, almost silently, pausing every few seconds to take a little hiccuping gasp of air. She's so quiet, almost as if she's afraid to make a sound. I hold her gently and murmur inanities over the top of her head, stroking her shoulders. I'm angry at my own helplessness. I've seen her upset before, but never anything like this. What happened? I ask, eventually, after the shudders give way to an occasional twitch.
You don't need to know, she sniffles. God, I'm a mess. Fetch the tissues.
We disentangle and I go in search of something for her to wipe her nose on. When I get back, she's sitting up, clutching her coffee mug and staring at the bricks around fireplace we've been meaning to get rid of ever since we moved in, with eyes like wrecking balls. I put the tissues in front of her on the table. She ignores them. Was it wet? I ask.
You have no need to...
She shudders slightly, puts the mug down and grabs a tissue. I notice her hands are a mess, reddish-brown grime ingrained around her nail beds. Jonathan Hoag territory. Holding the Kleenex to her face, she blows her nose once, twice, a peal of bloody trumpets.
It was ghastly. They made me... I think I can say this. Bob, remember the plumbers?
I nod. Deep in the pit of my stomach, I feel dread. The job in Amsterdam. They shut you up with a gash afterwards, didn't they? Was it that bad? No, don't try to tell me. You just stay right there. She nods convulsively.
I can't talk about it.
Emphasis on the can't. I stand up. I'm going to make a call. I go through to the kitchen and speed dial Andy.
Hello?
Andy sounds distracted. I take a deep breath. Pay attention now. I will ask this only once. Who should I blame for this? You or that motherfucker Tom in conflict resolution? Or someone else? Because I've got a situation here.
What?
Andy pauses.
Bob, is that you?
Mo is home from Amsterdam, I say carefully. She's in a state, and she can't unload on me because some cretin in plumbing has drawn the magic circle too tight. I don't know what happened out there, but she's about 2 millimeters away from a nervous breakdown. I can't help her if she's blocked from talking to me, so let me explain the situation in words of one syllable. You are going to get the Gesh relaxed so she can vent about whatever happened yesterday, or the laundry is going to have to replace a valued employee. No, make that 2. No, 3 new employees they'll be needing by the time I'm through with whoever's responsible. Capiche?
It wasn't me.
Andy sounds shocked.
Stay on the line. Where are you exactly?
I'm in the kitchen at home. That's on file as Safe House Lima 36. Mo was in the living room last time I looked. Is that exact enough for you?
Probably.
I hear keys clicking hastily, a keyboard on a desk near his phone.
Listen, you aren't cleared for this, and I can't do it over the phone. Normally, you would be cleared, but that inquiry that's pending has screwed up your... Look, I'm tied up right now, but I'll send someone round immediately as soon as I can find a warm body. Can you hold the fort for an hour?
Who are you going to send, exactly?
The office bloody intern, if I have to, as long as they've got an Oyster card and can carry a letter of release. Will that do you?
I sigh. It'll have to. Better hurry, though, or you're going to be short-staffed next week. I go back to the living room. Mo is sitting on the sofa, immobile, in exactly the position she was in when I left. I shove the coffee table aside and kneel in front of her. Mo, talk to me. She's staring right through me at the fireplace, vague and unfocused.
Can't,
she says. I called Andy. The reason it won't let you talk to me is the pending inquiry on my record. It, being the simple-minded Gesh someone in plumbing dropped on everyone who witnessed the scene in Amsterdam. I threatened to kick his ass, and he's sending a courier with a letter of release just for you. A physical token that will release her from the Gesh. He said it'll take about an hour, maybe a bit longer. Can you wait that long? Abruptly, she makes eye contact.
Oh, thank God, she says.
Then she slowly slumps forward, like a puppet whose strings have just been cut. 30 minutes later, the doorbell rings. I'm upstairs in the bedroom, sitting up with Mo, when I hear the chimes. It took a while to get her up there and into bed, propped up on pillows with the duvet pulled up to her chin, still wearing most of her street clothes, and a mug of coffee to hand. She's shivery and a bit shocky, but the colour has begun to return to her cheeks, and 10 minutes ago she asked me to bring her violin. She doesn't like to leave it unattended, and she's right. Fuck knows what would happen if one of the local lowlifes put a brick through the window and snatched it. The thing's about as safe as a loaded machine gun with no safety catch. So it's sitting on the bed, and she's got one hand on it just to maintain contact. We're talking inconsequentialities, waiting for the letter to arrive.
A weekend would be good, she agrees. If I can find a bed and breakfast in Harrogate. It won't be cheap, but it'll be quiet and there are places to walk, and it's not far off the East Coast main line.
Maybe York instead?
York, in summer? It'll be sunny, but the river smells.
Ding dong. That'll be the letter, I say, rising. Back in a minute. I'm through the door and taking the stairs 2 at a time. That was fast, I think, eagerly reaching for the door handle. My head hurts. Then the next thing I think is, that's funny. Why am I on the floor? I'm looking up, and my vision is blurred like a migraine. Uncle Fester leans over me, pointing a gun with a fat barrel at my face.
Где Жена?
He says. Huh? Actually, my face feels like it's split open. The bastard shoved the door in my face, hard. Uncle Fester pokes my forehead with the gun, provoking a bright metallic flash of pain.
Скажи мне сейчас, или я буду убивать вас.
He looks like Nico Bellic's mad uncle, the bad one with the child abuse convictions and the questionable personal hygiene, not to mention a bright red glowing zit in the middle of his forehead, and I am utterly fucked,
because I don't understand a word he's saying, but I'll swear I saw him or his twin brother at the bus stop yesterday. He's pulling back the gun. I can see its barrel looking huge and dark, and if I knew where my hands were, there's this neat trick you can do when some idiot points an automatic at you at short range. You grab the slide by laying your hand on top of the barrel and pushing back to stop the breech closing, which is a great secret agent stunt if you're not lying on the floor of your own front hall with one arm trapped under you and blood trickling down your face. "Do you speak English?" I ask. Uncle Fester looks annoyed.
"Where is he?"
I look him in the eyes and feel my guts freeze. I've been here before, staring at the luminous green worms swirling behind the glazed surface of his eyes, writhing in the muddy waters of a mind that's been sucked into a place where human consciousness melts like grease on a hot frying pan. There is a noise behind me, like a cat the size of a bus, yowling rage and defiance at a rival who has dared to enter his territory. Uncle Fester, or whatever it is that wears the mortal skin of a dead man walking, raises his gun to bear on the staircase. My left arm twists almost without me willing it, and I push at his right leg just above the ankle, shoving as hard as I can at his trousers. Don't think about what happens if you touch his flesh, because that would be as bad as not forcing him off balance while he's aiming at Mo. And he topples across me. These things are never terribly good at coordinating a tensegrity structure, like a mammalian musculoskeletal system. Even when they're in the driving seat, they're trying to work a manual transmission with automatic-only training. His gun bangs, a curiously muffled thudding sound as the feedback howl from the top of the staircase rises to a pitch that makes my teeth ache and overflows into an ear-numbingly harsh chord, music to snap next to. Uncle Fester goes abruptly limp as he falls on my legs. There's a horrid sigh and a smell I don't want to think about as unlife and animation departs.
"Bob?"
Her voice is small and terrified. "I'm okay," I call. "Are you?" Pause. "Check." She advances down the stairs, instrument raised and bow poised, wearing an intent, emotionless expression utterly at odds with her voice. As she comes closer, I see a trickle of blood emerging from her fingertips, where she grips the neck of the bone-coloured violin. There's always a cost to being entrusted with such instruments, and she's half-past overdrawn at the bank of life, her hands spidering twitchily as she stalks the house room by room, confirming that Uncle Fester was alone. My forehead's damp, and I feel sick. I reach out to push myself up, so I can shut the front door, in case a curious neighbour sees something that might damage their house valuation, and my vision blurs again. I try to wipe my face, and my hand comes away red and sticky. "That's odd," I tell myself. "I've never been shot before." Then everything gets very hazy and far away for a while. Chapter 4. Prompt Critical. Hospitals are boring places. My advice is to avoid them wherever possible, unless you happen to work there. Unfortunately, I'm not always good at taking my own advice, which is why I spend 3 hours in the A&E unit having my head bolted back together. Actually, that's a bit of an exaggeration. It's just a bash and a scrape to my scalp. But head wounds bleed like crazy, and they wanted to make sure I wasn't concussed and didn't have a fractured skull or a subdural hematoma or something. Then it was time for about 1 million butterfly sutures, and I'm told I may never be able to take the paper bag off in public again. But that's okay, because they let me go home with Mo, and the nice folks from plumbing who look like extras from The Matrix. Being attacked by a demonically possessed Russian with a silenced pistol is unusual, but not exceptional in my line of work. Sloppy of me not to have replaced my ward, though, or to have checked the spy lens in the door before opening up. Inexcusable not to have noticed that Andy's messenger was at least half an hour early, too. But in my defense, I wasn't exactly expecting to be attacked by a demonically possessed Russian with a silenced pistol. At least, I assume he was Russian. He was speaking Russian, wasn't he? I have some broken schoolboy French, therefore I'm from Quebec. Such are the perils of inductive logic. It was certainly demonic possession, probably class 2, one of the minor feeders in the night. Otherwise, I'd be worse than dead. Anyway, the point is, that sort of thing is just not done, at least not without some degree of warning, especially to someone who's signed off sick for the rest of the week, I'm feeling distinctly peeved. It's unprofessional. I'm just lucky Mo realized something was wrong and grabbed her violin in time to switch him off. She may be pale and shaking in the aftermath of something very bad, I guess, but she's a trooper, with a U, or trooper with an O, or something, and her reflexes are everything that mine are not. When we get home, our house has been invaded by spooks. An entire team of plumbers are at work, rewiring the perimeter defenses and daubing exclusion sigils on the window frames. Andy is sitting at the kitchen table, tapping his fingers, briefcase open, which makes it official. It's serious enough to drag management off-site.
Bob, Mo, good to see you.
He sounds relieved, which is worrying. Letter of release. I cross my arms.
You don't need it.
Andy glances at Mo.
Whether we like it or not, Bob is now involved in Club Zero. At least, I'm assuming that's what followed you home.
Oh, dear.
She says heavily and pulls out a chair.
Bob, I really didn't want...
Too late, whatever it is.
I grimace. I still feel a little sick, but it's mostly overspill from the music. Not concussion, just a little totem lead. And I'm heartsick for her, too.
Andy, what's going on?
Angleton's missing,
he says, with a curious little half-smile, as if he's just cracked a really filthy joke and is wondering if you've even heard the perversion he's alluding to.
Angleton's what?
Says Mo, just as I open my mouth to say exactly the same thing.
He's missing. Do you have any information? No, I guess not.
His cheek twitches. Mo reaches across the table and takes my hand. I barely notice. Angleton is just about the bedrock of the department. Yes, his position is shrouded in rumor and misinformation. To some, he's simply a DSS, a detached special secretary doing boring and esoteric work in arcana analysis. To others, he's involved in the occult equivalent of counter-espionage. But the truth is a lot weirder. Angleton actually gets to talk to the board, who nobody has actually seen in the flesh in 40 years. He's the whetstone that sharpens the cutting edge of the blade our political masters fancy they wield when they tell us what to do. The dog's bollocks, in other words. He's not the heart of the laundry. No one person is ever indispensable to any well-run agency. But he's probably important enough that if he is indeed missing, things are going to get unpleasantly exciting.
What happened? Mo asks.
He missed a meeting this morning. I went to look in on him. He wasn't in his office. A couple of hours later, I ran into Sally Alvarez from accounting, and she said he'd missed a meeting too. So I began asking around, and it transpires that he didn't check in this morning. Nobody's seen him since he went home yesterday evening.
Andy's bright and brittle tone reminds me of a thin layer of paint applied to cover the ominous cracks in the plaster that widen and shift over time.
Why didn't you phone him at home?
Asks Mo.
Because there's no home phone number on file for him.
Andy grins manically.
No address for that matter, would you believe it? HR don't have any contact details at all. Just a bank account and a P.O. box for correspondence.
But that's...
ridiculous.
Andy's smile slips.
Yes, I'd have said so. But remember, this is Angleton we're talking about. Did either of you see him yesterday?
The phrase, yes, I did, escapes before I can press my lips together. Mo gives me a withering look. I'm not concealing anything, I tell her. Nothing to hide. Andy goes for the jugular.
Tell me everything.
Not much to tell. I slump back on my chair. I was on my way home, but I figured I'd drop in on him on the way. I frown, then wince as the butterfly stitches on my forehead tell me not to be an idiot. The thing is, the other day, he sent me to Cosford to see something in a hangar.
The exorcism that went wrong,
Andy interrupts. No, not the exorcism. Something else. Something in the museum. It's his usual showing-not-telling thing. He wanted me to see it before he explained. So I dropped in to talk to him because I didn't manage to get to Hangar 12B in the end. He spun me some kind of line about an RAF squadron that was decommissioned in 1964, some photo reconnaissance unit or other, and gave me some file references to follow up next week. Squadron 666, he said. Yes, it was tangentially connected, but there's no bloody way of knowing what he's got in mind until you follow the trail of breadcrumbs he lays out for you. You know how he is, mind as twisty as a derivatives trader. Then he said something about wanting me to deputize for him on a code word committee, something like Bloody Baron.
Damn. What time was this?
About 12:15, I think. It was right after my session with Iris and Joe Sullivan. Why?
Because he was in the Ways and Means monthly breakout session on pandemic suppression systems that ran from 2 to 4, according to at least 6 eyewitnesses.
Andy looks gloomy.
Whatever happened, it wasn't you.
He glances at Mo.
What time did Boris call you?
She jerks upright and pulls her hand away from me. Around noon. Why?
Doesn't fit.
The pole hanging over him is threatening to throw a miniature thunderstorm.
You didn't run into...
He jerks his chin sharply over his shoulder. In the hall, one of the plumbers is reinscribing a do-na curve on the wall with a protractor and a rotary pen full of colloidal silver ink.
Until after. So it's not that.
What's not that? I ask. Andy takes a deep breath.
Angleton's missing. Work is following people home, and the Russians are trying to put the dead back into dead letter drop. You know the old saying, twice is coincidence, but 3 times is enemy action? Well, right now, I think it applies.
Was our visitor Russian?
Mo leans forward.
Don't know.
Andy looks mulish.
Did you get any indication of what he wanted?
He kept asking something, I volunteer, in at least 2 different languages, neither of which I speak.
Oh, great, he mutters.
Stretching, he shakes his head.
Been a bad day so far. Going to be a long one as well. Don't suppose there's any chance of a cup of tea?
Certainly. For you, I can recommend the special herbal teas, Monk's Hood and Spurge Laurel, although if you insist, I can make a pot of Tetley's.
That'd be fine.
Mo's sarcasm flies right past him, which is the final warning I need that Andy is about ready to drop. Time to ease up on him a little, maybe, if he grovels for it.
I'll get it, I say, standing up.
So let me see. Boris is running some kind of operation codenamed Bloody Baron, which involves something going down in Amsterdam which required Mo's offices and... They're both shaking their heads at me.
No, no,
says Andy, and...
Amsterdam was Club Zero, says Mo. It's a sideshow, and... Did you bring that letter?
Andy produces an envelope. She pockets it.
Thanks. Actually, it all boils down to Case Nightmare Green, Andy says heavily. The other operations are side projects. Case Nightmare Green is where it all starts.
Oh, yes? I ask casually, although those words send a chill up my spine.
Yes.
He laughs half-heartedly.
It appears we may have been working under some false operating assumptions, he adds. The situation seems to be deteriorating.
Case Nightmare Green is the code name for the end of the world. You might have noticed that Mo and I have no children. We don't even have a pet cat, the consolation prize of the overworked urban middle classes. There's a reason for this. Would you want to have children if you knew for a fact that in a couple of years you might have to cut their throats for their own good? We human beings live at the bottom of a thin puddle of oxygen-nitrogen vapor, adhering to the surface of a medium-sized rocky planet that orbits a not terribly remarkable star in a cosmos which is one of many. We are not alone. There are other beings in other universes, other cosmologies that think and travel and explore. And there are aliens in the abyssal depths of the oceans, and dwellers in the red-hot blackness and pressure of the upper mantle that are stranger than your most florid hallucinations. They're terrifyingly powerful, the inheritors of millennia of technological civilization. They were building starships and opening time gates back when your ancestors and mine were clubbing each other over the head with rocks to settle the eternal primate disagreement over who had the bigger dick. But the Deep Ones and the Thonians are dust beneath the feet of the Elder Races, just as much so as are we bumptious bonobo cousins. The Elder Races are ancient. Supposedly, they colonized our planet back in the Precambrian Age. Don't bother looking for their relics, though. Continents have risen and sunk since then. The very atmosphere has changed density and composition. The moon orbits 3 times farther out, and to cut a long story short, they went away. But the Elder Races are as dust beneath the many angled appendages of the dead gods who... You stopped listening about a paragraph back, didn't you? Admit it. You're bored. So I'll just skip to the point. We have a major problem.
The dimensions of the problem are defined by computational density and geometry. Magic is a branch of applied mathematics, after all, and when you process information, you set up waves in the Platonic ultrastructure of reality that can amplify and reinforce. To put it bluntly, there are too many humans on this planet. 6 billion-plus primates. And we think too loudly. Our brains are neurocomputers, incredibly complex. The more observers there are, the more quantum weirdness is observed, and the more inconsistencies creep into our reality. The weirdness is already going macroscopic. Has been for decades, as any disciple of Fortiana could tell you. Sometime really soon, we're going to cross a critical threshold, which, in combination with our solar system's ongoing drift through a stellar neighborhood, where space itself is stretched thin, is going to make it likely that certain sleeping agencies will stir in their eons-long slumber and notice us. Nope, we can't make Case Nightmare Green go away by smashing all our computers and going back to pencils and paper. If we did that, our amazingly efficient just-in-time food delivery logistics would go down the pan, and we'd all starve. Nope, we can't make Case Nightmare Green go away by holding a brisk nuclear war and frying the guys with the biggest dicks. Induced megadeaths have consequences that can be exploited for much the same ends, as the Ahnenerbe SS discovered to their cost. Case Nightmare Green is the demonological equivalent of an atomic chain reaction. Human minds equal plutonium nuclei. Put too many of them together in too small a place, and they begin to get a wee bit hot. Cross the threshold suddenly and emphatically, and they get a lot hot. And the elder gods wake up, smell the buffet, and prepare to tuck in. Our organization was formed as the British Empire's occult countermeasures organization during the struggle against Nazism, but it has continued to this day, serving a similar purpose, to protect the nation from an entire litany of lethal metanatural threats, culminating in the goal of surviving Case Nightmare Green. The UK's in a good position. A developed country, overwhelmingly urban, meaning its inhabitants are located in compact, defensible cities, with nearly neutral population size, no hotspots, and the world's most sophisticated surveillance systems. If you think the UK's been sliding into an Orwellian nightmare for the past decade, policed by cameras on every doorstep, you're right. But there is a reason for it. The Maginot Blue Stars defense network and its Scorpion Stare Basilisk cameras are fully deployed, ready to track and zap the first outbreaks. There are other, less obvious defensive measures. Our budget's been rising lately. Ever wondered why there are so many police vans with cameras on the streets? Case Nightmare Green is coming, and it's going to be perilous in the extreme. It's a bigger threat than global warming, peak oil, and the Cold War rolled into one. We may not live to see the light at the other end of the tunnel, as we finally drift out from the fatal conjunction, and the baleful stars close their eyes and reality returns to normal. Survival is far from assured. It may not even be likely. But one thing's for sure. We're going to give it our best shot. That evening, after the plumbers have upgraded our defenses and Andy has finished picking our brains and left, I order in a curry, paying strict attention to the spy hole this time when answering the doorbell, then retreat upstairs with Mo, a bottle of single malt, and a box of very expensive chocolates I've been hoarding against an evening like this. I'm dead tired. My face throbs around the butterfly sutures, and I feel unspeakably old. Mo is better than she was earlier, for what it's worth. Here. I pass her the Booja Booja box as I sit on the edge of the bed and unroll my socks. Oh, you shouldn't. Did you set the alarm? Yeah. You sure? The rest of my clothes are piling up atop the socks. Trust me, any burglar who tries their luck tonight is going to get the biggest shock of their life. Biggest, because afterwards they're going to run out of life in which to cap it. Remember, you need to deactivate it before you set foot on the stairs, or open any windows. And if the house burns down, and if the house burns down, yes. I shove the pillows up against the headboard. We're safe here, as safe as can be. Which isn't saying much if the bombshell Andy dropped turns out to be true, but I'm not about to remind her of that. I lean back. A wee dram? Don't mind if I do. How about death by chocolate? Sounds good to me. For a minute, we're silent. Me filling two glasses, Mo working her way into the box of cocoa-dusted delights. Presently, we exchange gifts. Outside, it's raining.
The rattle and slap of water on glass merges with the distant noise of wheels on wet road surfaces. But inside our insulated, centrally heated bubble of suburbia, we're isolated from the world.
By the way, I haven't said thank you, have I?
She asks.
What for? Picking up the pieces, bollocking Andy for me, being a dear, that sort of thing. Just existing when you get down to it.
I put my glass down. Thank you for saving my life this afternoon.
But if you hadn't punched his legs out from under him, he'd have shot me. He was going to shoot me first. Did you see where...
We stop, looking at each other in mutual disbelief and incomprehension. How did we get here? I ask her.
I don't know.
She frowns, then offers me the box of chocolates.
Pick one.
I pick something that looks like it came out of the wrong end of a hedgehog, except that it smells better. Why?
Let's see. That one's unique in this collection, right? Let's consider life as a box of chocolates. All of them are unique. Let each chocolate be a significant event. All we can say of any chocolate before we eat it is that it was selected from the slowly diminishing set of chocolates we have not already encountered. But one thing they've all got in common is
Theobroma cacao, I say, shoving it in my mouth and chewing.
Mmm. Yes. Now, let Theobroma cacao stand for the defining characteristics of our reality. We don't know precisely what the next chocolate will be, but we expect it to be brown and taste heavenly. But the previous chocolates we've eaten have narrowed the field of choice. And if, say, we've been picking the crunchy pralines selectively, we may find ourselves experiencing an unexpected run of soft centres.
I thought we were taking them at random.
No, we're picking them, without a menu card. But we can choose them on the basis of their appearance. Are you with me? We can choose our inputs, but not the outputs that result from them. And we have a diminishing array of options.
What kind of chocolate did you pick in Amsterdam? I ask.
She pulls her face. Wormwood. Or maybe Amanita phalloides.
The death-cap mushroom, so-called because the folks who name poisonous toadstools have no sense of humour. It's shaped like a cap, and you die if you eat it. Are you ready to talk about it? She takes a sip of Lagavulin.
Not yet.
Her lips twitch in the faintest ghostly echo of a smile.
But just knowing I can unload when I need to...
She shudders, then abruptly knocks back the contents of her glass in one.
Do you believe Andy?
She asks presently. I wish I didn't have to. I pause.
You mean about the acceleration?
Yeah, that. I fall silent for a moment. I'm not sure. I mean, he says it came out of Dr. Ford's work in research and development, using analytical methods to observe bias in stochastic sequential observations at widely separated sites, and Mike Ford's not the kind of man to make a mistake. Sly and subtle, with a warped sense of humour, and a mind sharp enough to cut diamond. That's our avuncular Dr. Ford. I'd love to hear what Cantor's deep-duration research team at St. Hilda's made of it, but I suspect you'd have to go all the way to Mahogany Row to get permission to talk to them about current work. They're sandboxed for a reason. Mostly to protect everybody else's sanity. It's a team of no less than 4 DSS-grade sorcerers working on a single research project for more than 30 years. They've grown more than slightly weird along the way. Just talking to them, then thinking too hard about their answers, can put you at risk of developing Kranzberg syndrome, the horrible encephalopathy that tends to afflict people who spend too much time thinking about symbolic magic. The map is one with the territory. Think too hard about the wrong theorems, and you shouldn't be surprised if extra-dimensional entities start chewing microscopic chunks out of your grey matter.
I want to see Ford's raw data, Moe says thoughtfully. Someone ought to give it a good working over, looking for artifacts.
Yeah. She puts her glass down and plants the box of chocolates on top of it.
If the acceleration is real, we've only got a few months left.
And there's the rub. What Ford has detected, so Andy told us, is an accelerating rip in the probabilistic ultrastructure of space-time. If it exists, if Dr. Ford is right, the first sign is that it will amplify the efficacy of all our thaumaturgic tools. But it'll gather pace rapidly from there.
He's predicting a phase change, like a pile of plutonium that's decided to lurch from ordinary criticality, the state of a controlled nuclear reactor, to prompt criticality, a sudden unwanted outburst of power, halfway between a normal nuclear reaction and a nuclear explosion. Nobody predicted this before. We all expected Case Nightmare Green to switch on with a bang, not a weeks-long transition, an explosion rather than a meltdown. For a few days, we'll be gods, before it tears the walls of the world apart and lets the nightmares in. Ought to make the best use of what time we've got left, she thinks aloud. I put my glass down and roll on my side to face her. Yes. Come here, she says, stretching her free arm towards me. Outside the window, the wild darkness claws at our frail bubble of light and warmth, ignored and temporarily forgotten in our primate frenzy. But its time will come. The next morning we oversleep by mutual consent, then slouch about the kitchen for a scandalously prolonged breakfast. Mo looks at me, sleepy-eyed with satisfaction, over a bare plate. I needed that. A guilty glance across at the empty egg carton by the frying pan on the hob. My waistline disagrees, but my stomach says fuck it. Enjoy it while you can. I've got plans for the weekend that include blowing a week's salary on stuff we might not need. Brown rice, lentils, canned beans, camping gas cylinders. I can make room for it in our abbreviated joke of a cellar if I toss the rusting bicycle and a bunch of other crap that's taking up space. I was thinking about going into the office this afternoon. But you're signed off sick, Mo points out. Yeah, that's a trouble. I refill my coffee mug from the cafetiere. After what Andy said, I figure I ought to at least poke around Angleton's office, see if I can spot something that everyone else has missed before the trail goes cold. And there are some files I want to pull, so I've got something to read over the weekend. You are not bringing work home. She crosses her arms, abruptly mulish. The thought never crossed my mind. I play the innocent expression card, and she raises me one sullen glare. I fold. I'm sorry, but there's also some reading matter I want to pick up. You're not bringing work home. We're not certified anyway. Yes, we are. As of yesterday, this is a level 2 secure site, I point out. I'm not bringing anything secret home, just archive stuff from the stacks. It's tagged confidential, but it's so old it's nearly ready to claim its pension. Strictly historical interest only. She raises an eyebrow. Why? Angleton, I swallow. When he sent me to Cosford, he forgot to give me the backgrounder first, but he gave me a reading list. Oh, fucking hell. She looks annoyed, which is a good sign. But then her eyes track sideways, and I realize I'm not off the hook yet. What's that? That? I ask brightly, suppressing the impulse to squawk, oh shit. It appears to be a cardboard box. A cardboard box with a picture of an iPhone on it, she says slowly. It's empty, I hurry to reassure her. Right. She picks up her coffee and takes a mouthful. Would I be right in thinking it's empty because it used to contain an iPhone, which is now, oh, I don't know, in your pocket? Yes. Oh, Bob, don't you know any better? It was at least a class 4 glamour, I say defensively, resisting the urge to hunch my shoulders and hiss, precious, and I needed a new phone anyway. She sighs. Why, Bob? Has your old phone started to smell or something? I left my PDA in Hangar 6 at Cosford, I point out. It's slightly scorched around the edges, and I don't have room for half my contacts on my mobile. So you bought an iPhone rather than bugging Iris to sign off on the replacement PDA? If you must put it that way. Yes. Mo rolls her eyes. Bob loses saving throw versus shiny with a penalty of -5. Bob takes 2d8 damage to the credit card. Just how much did it cost? Will you take it back if I guilt trip you hard enough? Do pigs fly? I was considering it, I admit, but then Brains came round and installed something. Brains installed? He's working on a port of offcut to the iPhone platform at work. I think he thought mine was an official phone. I've got to take it into the office and get it scrubbed before I even think about trading it in, or the auditors will string us both up by the giblets. I shudder faintly, but Mo is visibly distracted. Hang on,
They've ported Offcut to the iPhone. What does it look like?
I'll show you.
15 minutes later, I am on my way to the office, sans shiny. Mo is still sitting at the kitchen table with a cold mug of coffee, enthralled to the Jesus phone's reality distortion field, prodding at the jelly bean icons with an expression of hapless fascination on her face. I've got a horrible feeling that the only way I'm going to earn forgiveness is to buy her one for her birthday. Such is life in a geek household. Actually, I have a motive for going into work that I don't feel like telling Mo about. So as soon as I've stopped in my office and filled out a requisition for the file numbers Angleton scribbled on that scrap of paper for me, we can't get at the stacks directly right now. They're 50 metres down under the building site that is Service House, but there's a twice-daily collection and delivery run. I head down the corridor and across the walkway and up the stairs to the security office. Is Harry in? I ask the guy in the blue suit behind the counter. He's reading the afternoon Metro and looking bored.
Harry, who wants to know?
He sits up. I pull out my warrant card. Bob Howard, on active. I want to talk to Harry, or failing that, whoever the issuing officer is, about personal defense options.
Personal def...
He peers at my warrant card. Then his eyes uncross and he undergoes a sudden attitude adjustment.
Oh, you're one of them. Right. You wait here, sir. We'll get you sorted out.
Contrary to popular fiction, there is no such thing as a license to kill. Nor do secret agents routinely carry firearms for self-defense. Me, I don't even like guns. I mean, they're great fun if all you want to do is make holes in paper targets at a firing range, but for their real design purpose, saving your ass in a life-or-death emergency, no, that's not on my list of fun things. I've been trained not to shoot my own foot off, and I've been practicing regularly ever since the business on St. Martin, but I feel a lot safer when I'm not carrying a gun. However, 2 days ago, my primary defense ward got smoked in a civilian FATAC. Yesterday, I got doorstepped by a killer zombie from Jerzinski Square, and now I have a dull ache in the life insurance policy telling me that it's time to tool up, which in my case means basically dropping in on Harry, which means,
Bob, my son, and how's it going with you? Girlfriend glassed your head up?
Harry the Horse is our departmental armorer. He looks like an extra from The Long Good Friday. Belt-straining paunch that's constantly trying to escape, thinning white hair, and a piratical black eye patch. Last time I saw him, he was explaining the finer details of the care and feeding of a Glock 17, which we've standardized on, damn it, because of an ill-thought requirement for ammunition and parts commonality with a Sweeney. I responded by showing him how to take down a Medusa, something which I have unfortunately too much experience at. I recover from the backslapping and straighten up. It's going well, Harry. Well, kinda sorta. My ward got smoked a couple of days ago and I'm on heightened alert. There's been an incident.
As I can see from your head, my son. So you're thinking you need to armor up. Come right this way. Let's see what we can kit you out with.
He yanks the inner door open and pulls me into his little shop of... You know that scene in The Matrix when Neo says, "We need guns," and the white backdrop turns into a cross between Heathrow Airport and the back room at a rifle range? Harry's temporary office in the new annex third floor extension security area is a bit like that, only cramped and lit by a bare 60-watt incandescent bulb supervised by a small and very sleepy spider. Harry pulls something that looks like an M16 on steroids off the wall and picks up a drum magazine the size of a small car tyre.
Can I interest you in an Atchison 8A12 assault shotgun? Burst selectable for single shot or full auto? Takes a 20-round drum full of 12-gauge magnum rounds, and I've got a special loadout just for taking down paranormal manifestations. Alternate frag 12 fin-stabilized grenades, white phosphorus rounds, and solid silver triple-aught buck, each ball micro-engraved with a litany of Carnesh. Right up your street, my son.
He racks a slide on the AA-12 with a clattering clash like the latch on the gates of hell. I was thinking of something a little smaller, perhaps? Something I could carry concealed without looking like I was smuggling anti-tank guns on the bus.
Wimp.
Harry puts the AA-12 back on the rack and carefully stows the drum magazine in a drawer. I can tell he's proud of his new toy, which from the sound of it would certainly blast any unwanted visitor right off my doorstep. And the front path, and the pavement, and the neighbours opposite at number 27, and their back garden too.
So tell me, what is it you really want?
That's the cue for business.
First, I need to indent for a new Class 4 certified defensive ward, personal, safe to wear 24/7.
I pause. I also want to draw a hog, Cat 3 with silvered base and a suitable carrier. And, I steel myself, I'll take your advice on the next, but I was thinking about drawing a personal protective firearm. I'm certificated on the Glock, and a box of ammunition. I won't be routinely carrying it, but it'll be kept at home to repel boarders.
You don't need a Glock to get rid of lodgers, my son.
He spots my expression.
Had a problem?
Yeah, attempted physical intrusion.
Who else will have access to the weapon?
I choose my next words carefully. The house is a level 2 secure site. The only other resident is my wife. Dr. O'Brien isn't certificated for firearms, but she has other competencies and knows not to play with other kids' toys. Harry considers his next words carefully.
I don't want to lean on you, Bob, but I need more than your word for that. Seeing as how it's for you and the delectable Dominique, give her my regards, I think we can bend the rules far enough to fit, but I shall need to put a ward on the trigger guard.
How? That's new to me.
It's a new technique the eggheads in Q projects have come up with. They take a drop of your blood and key the trigger guard, so that the only finger that'll fit through it is yours. Of course,
his voice drops confidingly,
that doesn't stop the bad guys from chopping your finger off and using it to work the trigger, but they've got to take the gun and the finger off you before they can shoot you with it. Let's just say it's more about stopping pistols from going walkies in public than about stopping your lady wife from offing you in a fit of jealous passion.
I roll my eyes. Okay, I can live with that. He brightens.
Also, we can make it invisible and silent.
What? Hey, you mean you've got real concealed carry? He winks at me.
Okay, I would like that too.
As long as it's not invisible to me also. And, the holster. An invisible gun in a visible holster would be kind of inconvenient.
It'll be invisible to anyone who doesn't have a warrant card, my son, or your money back.
Will you match my life insurance, if it isn't, and some bright spark sets an SO19 team on me? One of the reasons I am reluctant to carry a handgun in public is that the London Metropolitan Police have a zero-tolerance approach to anyone else carrying guns, and while their specialist firearms teams don't officially have a shoot-to-kill policy, you try finding a Brazilian plumber who does call-out work during a bomb scare these days.
I think we can back that, yes.
Harry sounds amused.
Is that your lot?
It'll do. A new ward for myself, a hand of glory if I need to make a quick strategic withdrawal, and a gun to keep at home that I can carry in public if I absolutely have to. What more could an extremely worried spook ask for?
Ah, I know.
Do you have any alarms? I ask.
I thought you was dead set on home defence the DIY way.
Harry looks momentarily scornful, then thoughtful.
Things ain't that bad yet, are they?
Could be. I shove my hands deep in my pockets and do my best to look gloomy. Could be.
Whoa.
Harry's forehead wrinkles further.
Listen, there could be a problem. You drawing a hog and a gun and your good lady wife's violin, that makes you a regular arsenal, doesn't it? Now, if I was signing out an alarm to, oh, that nice Mrs. Thompson in Human Resources,
I shudder,
there'd be no problem on account of how she and her hubby and that no-good son of theirs ain't certificated for combat and wouldn't know a receiver from a slide if they trapped their fingers between them, right? But let me just put it to you. Suppose I sign an alarm out to you, put you and your missus on the watch list, and a bad guy comes calling at your front door. You and Dr. O'Brien go to the mattresses and you activate the alarm, and being you and the missus, you give as good as you get. 30 seconds later, the watch team are on your case and zoom in. Heat of battle, heat of battle. How do the watch team know that the people shooting from inside your house are you and your wife? What if you've gotten out through the back window? That's how blue on blue happens, my son. I figure you ought to think this one through some more.
Okay. I look around the compact armory. Guess you're right. We've got a panic button. It's part of the kit the plumbers fitted us out with. But an alarm of the kind I'm talking about is portable, personal. You carry it on your body and there's a limited list of folks who carry them. That kind of cover is computationally expensive. And if you're on the watch list and you trigger the alarm, Scorpion Stare wakes up and starts looking for you. And for everyone who might be threatening you. You don't want to press that button by accident, believe me.
One ward, one hog, and a +2 magic pistol of invisible smiting. Anything else I need to know?
Yeah. Come back in an hour, and I'll have all the paperwork waiting for you to sign. The hog and the ward I can give you once I get your chop. The pistol will take a little longer.
Harry shrugs.
Best I can do, all right?
You're a champ. I make my goodbyes, then head off. I've got other things to do before I go home. I'm on my way to Andy's office when Iris runs me down.
Bob, what are you doing here? I thought I told you to take the week off.
She sounds mildly irritated and a little out of breath, as if she's been running around looking for me.
Hey, what happened to your head?
I shrug. Stuff came up. She looks concerned.
In my office.
I demur. Her office is her territory. Look, Mo came back from a job. In pieces, really rattled. Then the job followed her home, and that's a full-dress panic. Her eyes narrow.
How bad?
This bad. I point to the row of butterfly closures on my head, and she winces. Have you heard anything about upswings in non-affiliated agency activity in London this week?
My office,
she says very firmly, and this time she means it.
Okay.
Once inside her office, she locks the door, switches on the red DND lamp, then lowers the blinds on the glass window that lets her view the corridor. Then she turns to me.
What code words do you know?
I've been approved for Club Zero, she gives a sharp intake of breath, and Case Nightmare Green, not to mention Maginot Blue Stars, but Harry the Horse wouldn't give me an alarm buzzer without your chop on the order form, and Angleton just told me to deputise for him on Bloody Baron, although I haven't been briefed on that yet.
Wow, that's a bundle.
She eyes me warily.
Angleton dumps a lot on your shoulders.
For someone so junior, she leaves unsaid.
Yes.
I focus on her more closely. Wavy chestnut hair that is currently unkempt and beginning to show silvery roots. Crow's foot worry lines at the edges of her eyes. A restlessness to her stance that suggests she's far busier than she wants me to see. Your turn.
Wait, first, what happened yesterday?
Andy was with the plumbers on cleanup. It should be on today's overnight events briefing sheet.
That was...
Her eyes widen.
You? Active incursion and assault by a Class 3 repelled by agents? Those stitches, it was that?
Yeah. I flop down on her visitor's chair without a by your leave. They tried to rearrange my features. It was a close call. I came in today to draw a personal defense item, but also to ask what the hell is going on.
Now, this business about Angleton. You saw him the day before yesterday.
Yes. I pause. He's still missing. Right? She nods. Do you want me to look round his office, in case he left anything? Iris sniffs.
No.
I think she's a poor liar.
But if you know anything...
I don't like being kept in the dark. Coming over all snippy on the person who is my nominal manager isn't clever, I know. But at this point, I'm running low on self-restraint. It seems to me that a whole bunch of rather bad things are happening right now, and that smells to me like enemy action. I'm echoing Andy. Whoever the enemy is in this context. Right, fine, you keep on playing games, that's all right by me. Except that it isn't really, because one of the games in question just followed my wife home and tried to kill her. Us. I point to the row of butterfly sutures on my forehead, and to her credit, she winces. Remember, it costs.
You've made your point,
she says quietly, sitting down behind her desk.
Bob, if it was just up to me, I'd tell you. But it isn't. There's a committee meeting tomorrow, though, and I'll raise your concerns. Ask me again on Monday, and I should be able to pull you in on the Bloody Baron committee, and at least add you to the briefing list for Club Zero. In the meantime, if you don't mind me asking, what items did Harry sign out to you?
He's processing them now, I enumerate. We've also had our household security upgraded, in case there's a repeat visit, although I think that's unlikely. We're alerted now, so I'd expect any follow-ups to happen out in public. It's riskier for them than it was, but right now the house is a kill zone, so if they want Mo badly enough, they'll have to do it in the street.
Ouch.
She leans back in her chair and rests one hand on her computer keyboard.
Listen, if you're really sure you want an alarm, I'll sign for one, but what Harry said? Listen to him. It's not necessarily what you need. The gun, well, you're certified. Certificated.
She gives a moo of annoyance at the mangled language we have to use.
Whatever, just keep it out of sight of the public and don't lose track of it. As for the rest...
She exhales.
There has been an uptick in meetings in public places conducted by three junior attachés at the Russian embassy who are esteemed colleagues in the dustbin,
she means the security service, popularly but incorrectly known as MI5,
have been keeping track of for some time. It's hard to be sure just which organization any given diplomat with covert connections is working for, but they initially thought these guys were FSB controllers. However, we've had recent indications that they're actually working for someone else, the 13th Directorate, probably. We don't know exactly what's going on, but they seem to be looking for something, or someone.
And then there was the Amsterdam business, I prod. Another sharp look.
You weren't cleared for that.
Andy procured a letter of release for Mo. I stare right back at her, bluffing. The I'll tell you my secrets if you tell me yours tap dance is a tedious occupational hazard in this line of work.
Well, yes, then.
The bluff works. That and her ward told her I'm telling the truth about the letter of release.
Amsterdam Club Zero was indirectly connected.
So we've got an upswing of activity in the Netherlands and the UK. Elsewhere in Europe, too? I speculate. Remember, I've sat in on my share of joint liaison meetings.
I can't comment further until after the steering group meeting tomorrow.
And my bluff falls apart.
I've told you everything I can tell you without official sanction, Bob. Get your kit sorted out, clear down your chores, and go home for the weekend. That's an order. I'll talk to you on Monday. Hopefully the news will be better by then.
This ends Disc 2.